Welcome to our Day 5 preview from the 2018 US Open. I'm Peter Rogers with Ravi Uber. A special welcome to tennis fans around the world listening in on Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open. Well, we've talked about Day 5 and what a phenomenal day that was. Let's just hope Day 6 is even half as good, because it should be spectacular if it is. Let's start off with the women's side of things. And we've got Keys against Krunic. Awkward player is Krunic. She's had some big wins here. There just seems to be some sort of magic that gets her going at these championships. Of course, different style to Madison Keys. What do you see happening in that encounter?
Yeah, Krunic, if memory serves me, beat Jo Konta at the U.S. Open, so she does know how to perform at this Grand Slam. It's always a tricky one for me when Madison faces somebody who can get a lot of balls back. She's such a great defender, Krunic, because the danger for Madison is that she can cough up the unforced errors, especially if, let's say, Krunic goes up early and Keys starts to press a little bit, so those unforced errors could increase even more. But having said that, I've been very impressed with the way that Keys, like Stevens, has gone about her business. I mean, she's defending all those points from making the final last year. She took on somebody who I wouldn't say is as good of a mover as her in the first round in Pauline Parmentier, but she can get a lot of balls back. And at times in that match, she was under some difficulty. You know, there were patches in that match where, you know, she just lost it a little bit. Parmentier had the upper hand before taking it back. And then the second round against Bernarda Pera, it's a different type of player. Pera is a very attacking, aggressive type of player. So Krunic has had very good success here in the past. It's a dangerous one for Keys.
The reason I started with that match in terms of our preview for tomorrow's action was because that is the first matchup on Arthur Ashe Stadium. So I'm going to go through the draw in terms of talking about each match with the order of play. And following that one, it is Nick Kyrgios against Roger Federer on Arthur Ashe in the day session.
It's going to be one to watch. You know, these guys know each other. They faced off three times, 2-1 to Federer, their head-to-heads. They played 9 sets, 8 of them have gone to tiebreak. So by that, we think it's going to be another close encounter. And of course, it's going to be the match after Mr. Kyrgios had his pep talk from Mohamed Layani, which certainly changed things. Even though Kyrgios was adamant, didn't really change things, the results said everything. You know, he was down a set, down a break, and then he got that conversation and it did turn around for him. This one, I don't think he's going to be in that situation early on where he's looking a little bit disinterested, because he knows this is a marquee matchup. He's going to be so looking forward to playing Federer on the biggest court in tennis. So I think his focus is going to be there from the outset, and that's why it's going to be a dangerous match for Federer.
Yeah, we've all got our theories about Nick Kyrgios and why he is such an enigma in terms of his attitude on the court. Do you want to hear my theory?
Sure,
on him?
Of course.
Okay, well, now I think he's someone who just has the biggest fear of losing than anyone else, okay? And he's so scared of losing it and looking like a fool against lower-ranked players where he knows he should be beating because he has the talent, that's what ends up him sort of showing, look, I'm not trying, so it doesn't really matter. Well, I lost to him, but I wasn't really trying, so I get out of that one. That's my theory with him there. It's a psychological thing of where he has that fear of losing too much, so he ends up not trying, so he doesn't ever end up being in that situation. Do you understand what I'm saying there?
I understand, yeah.
So then when he plays the bigger guys, the likes of Roger Federer and the greats of the game, that's why there's no fear of failure there, because he's up against someone who he's expected to lose against anyway. So he can just enjoy himself, he can focus. Even if he loses the match, no one's going to criticize him, no one's going to say, you know, that was a poor performance or anything like that, because that's why he seems to have that better focus. That's my theory on it. Of course, I don't know this personally, but just from watching over the years, that's what I kind of get as to why we've seen so many...
Well, I guess by that, in its simplest terms, you could say, okay, when there is no pressure on him, he plays well. When there is, you know, when he's going into a match that he should be winning on paper, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing for him. But when he goes on and faces somebody like a Federer or Nadal or Murray or Djokovic, that's a free hit.
And also, going back to my theory, is that he plays very well when he's in a team event. So when other people want him there, I think he's happy to fight for others more so than fighting for himself. Of course, he's a very well-liked person on the tour. As we've now seen, incidentally, not by everyone, of course, Donna Vekic with a tweet in terms of one of the first to tweet about that incident with Mohamed Layani. But we've certainly seen other players. Andy Murray, of course, rubbing salt into the wound with a little Instagram comment saying, when are you going to hire Liani as your coach?
And well, I mean, of the big four, it's pretty clear that Murray and him are the tightest. I mean, you're not going to say that Federer and him are tight, not going to say that Nadal and him are tight, nor Djokovic. So, I mean, it is really Murray when it comes to the big four who, you know, has the best relationship with him.
But you give him a chance tomorrow? Oh,
more than a chance. I mean, I would say 65-35 to Federer. He's going to lift his game. I mean, look what they've done based on their performances when they faced off. It's been very close. There's been nothing between them. There's been absolutely nothing between them. So, definitely has a chance, Kyrgios.
Really?
He's not going to, even if he beats Federer, he's not going to win the tournament because then he's going to have a little lull. But to win this one-off match against Federer, yes.
It is a match that there's just so many talking points in. But we must move on because there's plenty of other mouth-watering encounters coming up on day six. And as I say, moving through Arthur Ashe Stadium Court, the night match, the first of the night matches, Maria Sharapova against Yelena Ostapenko. We could see a fair amount of winners in that one, but also a fair amount of unforced errors. What is going to decide the match for you?
I think Sharapova has to serve very well because she struggled with the double faults in her win in the second round, so she needs to shore up that part of her game. I think it carries over sometime into her ground game, even though you don't normally see her. It doesn't come across in terms of her expressions that happens. So I think she needs to serve very well. When they met during the clay swing, it was like a massive battle. It was a three-hour match they had earlier in the season, but that was a time, I think, when Ostapenko wasn't playing very good tennis. I mean, she was having the pressure of going into the French Open, leading into it, knowing she has all those points to defend. She had a very good Wimbledon, making the semifinal. So I don't think the match is going to be, for me, as close as it was earlier. I would go with Ostapenko in straight sets.
There you go. You hear it here first. I like how you're also not sitting on that fence that so many colleagues that I speak to so often do so. As for the final night match of the evening on Arthur Ashe Stadium, it's Novak Djokovic against Richard Gasquet. Djokovic has dropped a set.
Can I just stop you there, Pete? Novak in three.
Okay.
That's not that we don't need to talk at length about Novak.
We'll move on then. Okay. I love your confidence in Richard Gasquet.
Just look at their head-to-head record. Look at his record against the big four. I mean, that speaks volumes. He's a great shot maker, Gasquet. Mm. You know, he's a wonderful one-handed backhand still. But, you know, just like the Del Potro-Verdasco match, where in parts it was close, you just knew what was going to happen in the end. And for Djokovic, I think he needs to have a mega, mega, mega off day to lose.
I do agree with you, despite criticizing you for being so bold with your statement.
That's not a bold statement. I think everybody out there would say that Djokovic is going to win this one.
We've got to try and make it in. We want the people to tune in. Otherwise, if people just think it's going to be three sets, we want them to tune in. You never know with Djokovic. He has dropped two sets already in his first two rounds. So, and you never know with this beautiful sport that we have. Kiki Bertens starts things off on the Louis Armstrong Stadium Court. She's in fine form, looking to continue that fine form against Markéta Vondrousova. If you haven't seen or heard Vondrousova play before, she's an exceptional young talent, and of course having a brilliant US Open. So that should be a very interesting match, seeing whether Bertens can win that one. Then we have Domenica Sibulkova, of course a former Grand Slam champion, a former WTA Finals winner. And who did she beat in the final of the WTA Finals, I hear you ask? It was Angelique Kerber, and she is playing her again tomorrow. Kerber hasn't played her best tennis as of yet. In terms of the players she's faced, there have been players that you would have expected her, if she was playing at a peak, to come through quite easily. Yeah. She struggled through those two matches. Domenica Sibulkova, though, a different proposition altogether. So this one isn't as easy as calling Djokovic against Gasquet. Can you see an upset happening here?
Yes, I can see an upset. As much as I put Kerber in my mix of players who I think can win the U.S. Open, Sibulkova, you just have to marvel what she does. You know, she doesn't have the height advantage that other players do, but she hits the ball so, so hard. Her approach to the game is amazing. You know, for tennis fans, they'll know what she brings to the court. For non-tennis fans, the casual fans, I think it's worth pointing out that Sibulkova, for me, is one of the game's best competitors. I mean, it's never a lost cause for her. I mean, she's always bobbing up and down to receive serve. She never puts her head down. It may not be going her way, but she never lets that happen to her. That's why I think this could be a long, long match. And Kerber in her last match against Johanna Larsson, it was 6-2, 5-2. That match was going to be over very, very quickly. What happened? ended up going three. It was a long three-setter in the heat. So playing around an hour and 20 or 30 minutes extra in those conditions, and I just think in the back of my head that that could be a factor tomorrow.
Following that match, we've got an all-German affair, Philipp Kohlschreiber against Sascha Zverev. I've obviously talked in the past about how I feel this could be Zverev's tournament, at least to make a final or at least do something big in a Grand Slam for the first time. We're not going to focus on that match, though. The last match I want you to focus on is the first of the night session at Louis Armstrong Stadium. Now, we've been talking about our picks before the tournament, and I said for me there were six players in the women's draw that could possibly go on and win it. Two of them coming head-to-head for me here, Petra Kvitova against Aryna Sabalenka. I mean, I wouldn't want to be a tennis ball in that encounter.
No, I mean, they're two of the biggest hitters in the women's game, no question about that. And I wouldn't have put Sabalenka in my list of players to win because, I mean, listen, she's gone up, skyrocketed in the rankings in the last year.
She was the sixth.
Fell in qualifying last year at the U.S. Open. She just won a title in New Haven, first title for her. So to rebound from that, to recover, to go another long two-week stretch, I don't see that happening. That doesn't necessarily mean I don't think she can pull off the upset tomorrow, because that can happen. I just wouldn't see her going, you know, lasting the course in terms of, you know.
Yeah, winning seven matches in a row is very, very tough to do. But to then win, what would it be, 12 matches in a row, even harder. But the reason I put her in the bracket is just every time I've seen her go on a run at a tournament, and she's had lots and lots of long matches in those tournaments, she just doesn't look fatigued by the end of it. She also is completely fearless.
Yep.
And so I don't think she would be even fazed by reaching a Grand Slam final.
We
could have the Ostapenko situation again, which we had at the French Open. Other matches to look out for tomorrow: Cilic against Dimitrov, Milman Kukushkin, Siniakova Serenko, Osaka Sasnovich. Osaka going through the draw very quietly, of course, winning in Indian Wells. Schwartzman Nishikori, that's the last match over on Grandstand.
That'll be a great one to watch.
Entertaining one. If you like your long rallies, go and sit down on Grandstand Court and watch that one if you're coming tomorrow. Garcia Suarez Navarro, Puy against Sosa, and Struff against Goffin. Those three matches all on Court 17. It's an action-packed day. It should be an absolute stunner. And of course, after tomorrow's play, we will know the round of 16. We will know who are in the fab round four of the tournament. And that is our preview of day six of the 2018 US Open for Ravi Uber. I'm Pete Hodges. Thanks for listening. Join us for complete live coverage every day on US Open Radio, presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the US Open app.
Celebrating 50 years of the US Open with the one and only Chrissy Evert. Chrissy, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Steve, thank you for asking me.
Now, let's start, Chrissy, let's go back to the 71 Open. Now, you had had a stunning victory over Margaret Court when you were 15 in 1970, just a couple weeks after Margaret had won the Grand Slam. But in many ways, you launched your career by that run to the semifinals as a 16-year-old and at the U.S. Open of 1971. And during that two-week stretch, you had three remarkable comebacks against Marianne Eisel, Frankie Durer, and Leslie Hunt. And the Eisel match, of course, was the standout because she was serving for the match up triple match point at 6-5, 40-love in the second set. And somehow you saved six match points altogether and won it. Try to put all that into perspective. A 16-year-old playing your first major tournament, having still been combining juniors and women's events that summer, and here you are making this incredible splash in New York.
Well, I was a kid. You know, I was a kid, and it was my first, like you said, it was my first U.S. Open, and I think I'd won the 18 Nationals by that time, and,
yep.
You know, like you said, I'd started to play some women's tournaments, but I think the U.S. Open, that was the start of my career, no doubt, just because the drama of it, and I remember that they put me on center court every single match, which was kind of cool. And my first round was against Etta Budding, right?
Yes, Etta correct. Budding. Correct.
And was that 6-love, 6-love? Or was that 6-love, 6-1?
Yeah, you lost one game.
Oh, it was 6-love, 6-1, right?
Yeah.
But at that time, I think she was the number one German player. And for me, you know, to win that easily at the U.S. Open, it kind of like opened my eyes a little bit to the fact that I could play, you know, with the big girls. But as you mentioned, that match with Marion Eisel, even as I look back now, I don't know how the heck I got through that match. And, you know, all I can say is that I never felt any pressure, even on the match points. You know, I just, it was not a big deal. If I lost, I lost. And I didn't put any pressure on myself. I remember thinking that the ball looked bigger than usual when I was match point down, because I think I was down 6 match points.
Yes, and, correct.
And, you know, again, I just went for my shots. And I think that was really the big match. I don't know what would have happened if I would have lost that match. I mean, because I just think that getting to the semifinals at the U.S. Open really set the tone for the rest of my career. Not that I wouldn't have had a great career, but it would be interesting to see what would have happened. It might not have happened. I might not have had a great year or two after that. I don't know. So I got through the match with Marion Eisel, and then I remember...
Do you remember that it was televised? You know, Bud Collins in the booth?
I do remember. And yeah. I've YouTubed it. I've gone back and listened to it, too. It's pretty funny to hear Bud Collins commentating. And then the next round was that...
French Wadur. Yeah.
And then every match had a drama, because Frankie Durr, after I beat her, you know, she was like in tears. She was in tears on the court because the crowds were so pro me being young and being an American and encouraging me to do well. And she was just so frustrated. She's, you know, a French player. She was so emotional anyway. So I remember she was in tears on the court. And then Leslie Hunt, again, you know, really a serve and volleyer, very much like Marion Eisel, a serve and volleyer and really tough grass court player. But I got past her. By then, there was just so much publicity. And I was staying with my aunt and uncle, with my mom and my aunt and uncle out in Larchmont. So I had like, an hour and a half drive. Every day, we didn't even stay in the city. We had an hour and a half drive every day, driving to the U.S. Open and back. And they were making me make my bed and take the dishes out of the dishwasher and do the dishes. And, you know, I was not that I shouldn't, but I mean, staying in a hotel, you kind of have privileges where you're not doing these things. And, you know, I was still living like, you know, a 16-year-old girl, but yet I was becoming a star, I think, that those 2 weeks at the U.S. Open. So by the time I reached the semifinals, I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Now, and, were you reading the newspapers every morning or watching the news at night?
You know, I was, but it didn't faze me at all. You know, it just didn't faze me at all. It was like I was winning tennis matches, and that's really the perspective that I had. I was winning tennis matches, and I made the front page of the New York Times. You know, I was like, okay, that's really nice. You know, but in my own way, I didn't get carried away with myself. And it did not put extra pressure on me.
And not intimidated by being interviewed by Howard Cosell.
No, well, that was after the Billie Jean match, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was that
yes.
after I lost?
That's
yeah.
true.
So
yeah.
What was intimidating was going into the press room with you guys after my matches, because, you know, I really wasn't versed on any prep. I mean, I didn't have any preparation for that or any training for that. And it was like people were sticking microphones in my face and asking me these questions. And all my replies were, you know, I felt really good. I didn't feel nervous. And I just went out there and I played well. And I mean, it's just the simplest answers, but you know, I think that was really intimidating, because I felt like I was in a room full of some very intelligent, probing people that wanted to know more than I was willing to give out.
And you felt it was hard not to be a little robotic at times, wasn't it? I mean, you weren't used to doing these press conferences.
No, it was. I was like a fish out of water, and my answers were one sentence, and I didn't really want to talk about, you know, my school and my family life. And yeah, it was like, whoa, you know, you can ask me about the match or what. So that was very intimidating. But my match with Billie Jean, you know, I remember that was really special. And we're walking out, this is at Forest Hills, so, you know, we didn't have bodyguards to walk out. I mean, we walked the whole length from the locker room to center court. And when we walked, there were people on both sides of us roped off. But, you know, there's a lot of people. And Billie Jean, I remember when we were walking out, she said to me, "You're riding on the crest of a wave. Enjoy it." And, of course, as 16, I didn't know what the heck she was talking about. And I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, but did you think she was trying to psych you out in a way, or was that just conversation?
Yeah. I thought that she was trying to get into my head a little bit, because as junior players, nobody ever talked to each other when they're walking out to the matches. You know, we didn't talk to each other. So I thought, okay, fine. Oh, thank you. But, you know, now be quiet so I can go play my match. So we went out there, and I remember thinking, you know, Billie Jean, I mean, she beat me by just playing smart tennis. She beat me by slices and dices and topspin and drop shots, and she didn't overpower me, and I don't know, she just outsmarted me. She just took away my rhythm, and I couldn't play my game at all. I couldn't find my timing. She took away all of my strengths, but she was very, very smart about it. And the other women, they just tried to power through me. That hadn't worked. So I think she specifically thought before the match, specifically what kind of strategy, and she changed, because she didn't play other women this way. She didn't play other players the way she played me that match in the semifinals. So,
but she didn't really have a choice, right? I mean, I think in a way she felt that there was no alternative, because if she didn't mix things up and if she wasn't creative, you were going to beat her.
No, for sure. I'm complimenting her on how smart she was and the tactics that she did use. And it was, again, I was surprised that she was hitting the ball soft, and I was surprised that she was hitting it with a lot of slice. But as the match went on, I realized as I looked at the scoreboard that it was working. So I didn't feel like I got blown off the court, but I felt like I definitely got outsmarted. And then when I lost that match, then I was interviewed by Howard Cosell. And again, the press conference was another intimidating press conference. But, you know, it was a Cinderella story, you know, quite frankly. I mean, that was my first tournament that, I mean, what a great tournament to blossom at and to come at, to having a coming out party at the U.S. Open, your own country's championship. You know, couldn't have been more ideal. It couldn't have been more perfect for me. And ironically, I was invited the year before when I was 15 to play the U.S. Open, because that was the year I won the 18 Nationals when I was 15, and the 18 National champion got right into the main draw. And I remember my dad turned and said, "No, she's not ready." So he thought I was ready that year when I was 16, and he was right.
Absolutely. Well, Chrissy, you were still an amateur that year in 71. You didn't turn pro until you turned 18, but could you have envisioned at that stage this soaring prize money, this game that was taking off, particularly the women's game, because the Virginia Slim Circuit had really just started that year. The nine players had signed their contracts in 70, and on 71, the year that you got to the semis of the Open, that was the first year really of the tour. I mean, could you have ever have envisioned then at that age where everything was headed?
No, but remember, I was only 16, so it's like I hadn't lived the circuit before that. You know, I really wasn't that familiar. All I was familiar with was junior tennis and then women's tennis for just a couple of years. But no, I wouldn't have envisioned it to have taken off the way that it did. But again, my dad, who was my coach, my father, made all the decisions for me at that time. At 16, I wasn't really educated and aware, and I didn't see the social aspect of what women were going through and equality, and I didn't understand that, you know, the women were receiving 10% of the prize money of men. I mean, I thought, you know, I understood it, but I just thought women athletes are relatively, that was kind of a new concept, and they'll work their way into it and get equal prize money sooner or later. But at that point, it was so uneven. But again, I was so young that I am protected that I didn't know the full consequences of the movement, what was going on in the early 70s with women.
So you went home, but you obviously, when you left the Open.
Oh my gosh, I went home.
You're trying to digest it all, and did you really feel pretty soon thereafter that your life might have changed forever? That was a lot to get a hold of.
Yeah, I felt it did for sure, because I went home. I flew home, and the whole school came out to meet me at the airport, so I guess so. You know, the band was there, and the school was there, and as I got off the plane, they announced, could Chris Evert please wait until the end, you know, the last person to get off the plane. So I got off last, and I went back to the school, and I had to make a speech, and the next day, Life magazine came to my class and took pictures. So I knew at that point that my life had changed and that I was going to be under the microscope. I mean, even at that young of an age, I felt like I was going to be living under a microscope from there on in.
Well, no doubt about it. I mean, you had become a celebrity very, very swiftly mm-hmm. there. But let's move ahead to this, to the, your first victory at the Open in 75, because by then, yeah, your career had totally taken off, and you're number one in the world, and you'd already won a couple of French, and you'd won Wimbledon in 74 the year before.
Yeah.
But now this was the year that the U.S. Open switched to clay, or Hartshoe to be more exact, and you hadn't lost on clay for a couple of years, and it all came down to this enthralling three-set final between you and the carefree Yvonne Goolagong, and you fought back to win it 6-2 in the third. Talk about the gratitude of winning your country's championships for the first time, and also the sight of your mother sobbing in the stands when it was over.
I know. Oh, my heavens. I remember, first of all, playing Yvonne was always tough because she's such a wonderfully natural athlete, and I find myself watching her, the way she moves and the way she hits the balls with such grace, and I had to keep telling myself, watch the ball, don't look at her. She was such a great player, but winning that, I did feel pressure in that match because I always thought that I was a better clay court player than Yvonne and that I should win that match. But after I pulled out that match, I remember looking up and seeing my mom, not with a few tears, but sobbing. And I was like, whoa. And I was the kind of player that, you know, I kept everything in and I didn't show emotions. And I looked up and I saw her sobbing, and I'm like, that's probably the way I should have been feeling, but I wasn't. But I realized how much it meant to her to have her, to see her daughter, you know, win a major championship. And I think that took precedent over me winning. It's just seeing that. It still is with me today.
Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.